Hi, it's Susan, and I'm an expert in helping musicians to have better relationships with themselves and with the world. In this episode, we meet Anna Schaum, violist and therapist, and Anna has a deep commitment to healing and building bridges between people. She's able to do this so well because she can listen deeply, which is a skill that she honed during her training and career as an orchestral musician. Enjoy. Welcome to today's episode of the Change Your Tune podcast. I'm your host, Susan Eldridge, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome a guest today. Speaking to us today from Portland, Oregon, is a therapist, educator, facilitator, mediator, musician, and founder of the Center for Sound Relationships, Anna Schaum. Anna, welcome.
Thank you, Susan.
So many titles, Anna, but all centered through the thread of working with others. Can you tell us about the work that you're doing at the moment?
The work I'm doing is pretty diverse. I continue to work with individuals in my psychotherapy practice, which has, since COVID-19 took our lives, been virtual on Zoom for over a year. I'm also facilitating groups with an international employee assistance and resilience program as part of their diversity, equity, inclusion initiative, running affinity groups for white-bodied individuals to reckon with our particular role and responsibility in anti-racism and unpacking the isms that affect all of us in systems of oppression. And I'm also in a part-time role at our family business as the director of eco-social development. And it's an international e-commerce photo studio. And so I am bringing everything I've learned about wellness and health and healing and relationships and ecology straight home to that organization as they grow.
And Anna, how did you come? We mentioned also that you're a musician, as well as all of the other incredible change making that you do. How does the musician part fit into this story?
Well, I heard the viola in the fourth grade for the first time when two wonderful women came to my school and played the violin, the viola, and the cello. And I heard the sound of the viola's voice and said, "That's the one, I'm in love." And so we know the viola is the harmonizing instrument in the orchestra. And that's basically what I do, is I harmonize in systems. I think of myself as an instrument when I'm working with people. And sometimes I'm like a tuning fork. Other times I'm just listening to the other voices in the room and helping them to coordinate through their discontents or their passing tones.
Anna, so you trained in music. So I would love you to share the journey of from playing viola in school through the awakening and the understanding you had of your skill and ability to do this work to the work that you're doing now. How did that journey unfold?
Well, like most journeys, it was a circuitous, adventurous path. I think the first major impact was I had just won the principal position for a summer orchestra in Colorado. And I was in my mid-20s, and it was a real gift to have won that position. And I took my bicycle to the summer festival. And I had these great aspirations that I was not only going to play music all summer, but I was going to get in great shape and bicycle and mountain climb and learn to climb the sides of the mountains in Colorado. And on our second rehearsal, I was speeding around the boulder bike path and it started to rain and the bike path became slippery and my bicycle went out from under me. And when I crashed to the ground, of all the bones to break in a violist's body, I broke my left collarbone. So I was really forced to stop playing for the first time in my career for about 2 months. And I couldn't drive back to Portland, which was my home, because I had a stick shift car. So I spent 2 months walking around, went to the Boulder bookstore, started reading books and discovering that some people thought like I did. It just came out very differently. I read books on philosophy and psychology and spirituality. So that was kind of the awakening. And then when I got back to Portland, I realized I needed to do more than play music. Something really kind of was broken up in that accident. I started doing improv comedy for 2 years. I was in a wonderful troupe and enjoyed the ensemble of that kind of work versus the ensemble of playing music. And then I guess a really important experience was being on an airplane. I was taking the San Francisco Symphony audition, and I'd told myself these auditions are too expensive and too hard on my ego, even though I'd gotten really close in winning a job past the Oregon Symphony. And I was coming back on that plane trip and had a really eventful experience sitting next to a couple. So I can tell you more about that if that would be useful. Yeah. So I'm sitting next to this couple, and I was in the seat on the aisle, and there was a man in the middle and a woman on the window. And I recognized through my body just the energy that they had, that something was not right. And he would do things like, when they brought food — this is back in the days when they still brought trays of food on the planes — they brought the food, and he took his and put it on his tray, and then he took hers and put hers on his tray and didn't give her food. That's odd. And then, you know, he took a nap, and he woke with such a start, it seemed too dramatic, and threw his arm to the right and hit her. And so my whole body was just seized up with energy. I felt inflamed. I wanted to say something. I didn't know what to say. I think I was maybe 31 years old at that time, by that time. And so when he got up to go to the bathroom, I slipped her my phone number and said, if you need to talk to someone, call me when we land. And she never called. But when I got home, I signed up to work on the Portland Women's Crisis Line and started doing volunteer work and looking around for how I could use that ability to listen and connect with people without the instrument.
And thank you for the vulnerability and openness that you extended to that woman. I mean, we don't know the seeds we sow. We will never know. But thank you for seeing her and acknowledging her in that moment.
I didn't win the job, by the way. I didn't win. And I had told myself, if I don't win, I'm going to find something else to do with my life. So I had a strong hit that this had something to do with that.
Wow.
So it wasn't only self-serving.
Well, none of it is self-serving, Anna, because what I'm hearing you speak about is even after you had the bicycle injury, is seeking curiosity and seeking beyond yourself. And I'm wondering if that's, as you talk about your experience as having been a harmonizing instrument rather than a leading voice in the ensemble, if that's embedded in the experience, is, well, my responsibility is to uplift and support others musically. And if that's sort of become, you've filtered through and become more of who you are, because I wanted to ask what drew you when you're talking about being in that bookstore in Boulder. I would imagine I can envisage other young musicians, say the first violin player, no shade violin players, I love you, but their awareness of the world beyond themselves, having space for that to be broader than it currently is. But you said you went into the bookstore looking for books and reading books about philosophy and psychology, and that's not maybe a common choice for a young musician. I would imagine they would be in there looking for biographies of composers and performers. So what drew you at that point to be looking beyond yourself.
Well, that's a big question. I've been studying a lot about intergenerational trauma and ancestry. And so my cosmic answer, and my, I guess it's becoming even more scientific now with epigenetics, is that it was my grandmother or my grandmothers who drew me to those books. My father's mother was wanted to be a singer. But she lived in a time where she didn't have access to that role. And so I think there's a part of me that's both wanting to uplift others, but also to connect with something greater and more vast than my individual self, the individual self of the musician, and sort of beyond the ego. And I think that was a time that I recognized that there were other ways of looking at what music means in the world. There are other ways of singing and harmonizing and bringing peace and having an impact on the future.
And I wish more young musicians had this experience of, I guess, communion and service through the ensemble. So I see so much of this young ensemble experience being about excellence and perfection. And I don't think those things have to be contrary to emotional connection, but often those things don't exist together, and I wish we had much more of the youth orchestra or the youth choir experience that was about the music is asking us to be vulnerable, or the music is asking us to be whatever the emotion is of the music. And I think if we had music educators who were able to use not flowery language that's unclear and unhelpful, but language that was emotionally charged, that gave all the information about the articulation and the dynamics, like in this part of the march, Stravinsky's requiring us to be strident. Cellos, can you be more strident in your playing? Would give them all the information they need, as well as the emotional connection, and ask them, support them, and ask them to feel their feelings and to feel the feelings of the music rather than cellos, it's too loud. And I'm wondering, was that an experience as a young musician that you had, of the music being much more connected to feeling and emotion than technique and precision?
It's like another good question. Well, I think I just came into the world as a big feeler. I'm an empath and an emotional sponge. But my viola teacher was an amazing human being, Manuel Diaz. He's actually Roberto Diaz, who's the president of Curtis Institute's father. And I found out at age 40 that Manuel was born in Spain during Franco's dictatorship and came to was taken to Chile as an immigrant on a ship when he was 4 years old, on a boat chartered by Pablo Neruda, the poet. And then in the 70s, when Pinochet power came on in Chile, Mr. Diaz and his family were able to get out of Chile at the very last minute. And somehow, by some grace of miracle on Earth, planet Earth, Mr. Diaz ended up my viola teacher in the 7th grade in Atlanta, Georgia. So I was exposed to someone who had been through so much. And I think that I picked that up through him, through the energy of his body, through the way he taught me, through his. He was a humble man. He still is such a humble, loving, creative man. He never let on that he'd lived through that, not once, but twice. And so I feel so grateful to be sort of this lineage holder of, when we talk about intergenerational trauma, Mr. Diaz's way of doing life and emotional energy. He was not a perfectionist.
And I think it's the gift we have on those rare moments where we do come into contact with other humans who've had some life thrown at them, is, I'm sure, as you said, you had no idea that this was Mr. Diaz's story, but by golly, he had something to say through music about life. Mm-hmm. And yes, that's where that it doesn't, again, it doesn't need to be spoken in, it transcends language and just becomes about feeling. And that's, that must have been your experience with him, is he's really saying something and he's asking me to say something through the music.
And he's asking me to listen. He taught me to really listen, to listen to my intonation, to listen to my tempo. He was always saying, Anisham, why are you rushing? Slow down. And so, you know, and I'll take a leap here, Susan. In the US, at least, there's a lot of literature out right now on cultures of white supremacy. And the literature speaks of urgency and individualism and perfectionism as characteristics. And I'm not talking about the tattoo kinds of white supremacy. I'm talking about the kind that's systemic, just because of the way our cultures have formed over time through many continental shifts. And so I believe that we actually have a huge opportunity, because we represent in so many ways. European classical music represents alignment with colonial practices, that we also have an opportunity and a responsibility to find ways to ease up on that individualism, to find ways to work collectively, to find ways to lift up voices that are precious and need to be part of the conversation going forward of our human orchestra. And in order to do that, we need to get out of our ego's path. Egos are important. We need them to move us around, but they are here to support our creative mind. They're not here to run the show.
That's everything, Anna, is that the responsibility that we have to use our gifts for others. And what I'm seeing, and we're having a very different experience here in Australia than is happening, particularly in North America and Britain now, around diversity. And what I'm seeing is and hearing a lot of in people's writing is an inability to hold tension, and particularly where that tension is the choices that we've made in the past we now know to be racist and incorrect and hurtful to many others. And that's the space I'm seeing people struggling with, about acknowledging that the truth telling part, mm-hmm. when the truth is really, you spoke about before about all the isms. What do you have to speak to on that, this truth telling before we get to the reconciliation?
I love this conversation. I actually have a method, and I've written an article for the Journal of Psychodrama, Sociometry, and Group Psychotherapy for a practice called Tune Up. And Tune Up helps us to find the balance point, just like the bridge helps an instrument find the balance point on an instrument, between what are opposing, seemingly opposing values, that when they're not both recognized, when we don't have a both and perspective on our value sets, that we go into polar opposition. So this is a big subject. I would love to talk to you about it a lot, but that ability to hold tension is what musicians certainly know how to do. The tension between the harmonious and concordant chords and the disharmonious and dissonant chords. We call them passing tones. It's no big deal. Tension is part of it. Pressure is also part of it. We need pressure of the bow on the string and the embouchure on the mouthpiece. And conflict is even part of it. Conflict means strike against. So if we think of conflict as two cymbals crashing, like a wake-up call after a long grand pause, versus swords clashing, where we're going to actually kill each other, we can reframe what those things mean. And we have the technology. So tune-up literally looks at the both ands. For instance, throw out, what's one of your most precious values?
Empathy.
Okay. So if when we're doing the tune-up practice, I just invite people to feel what empathy feels like in their body. And we have the Museum of Empathic Attunement. Like, let's say you go up to a sculpture and you see the empathy sculpture. What is it doing? It might be, what is your body gesture when you do empathy?
Oh, what is my body gesture when I do empathy? I try and have a smiling torso. So shoulders back. And I'm not quite sure what I do with my hands, but I know that it's the smile across the torso.
Beautiful. So you have this beautiful felt sense in your body. So it's not just a value in your mind, it's embodied. So if we look in the dictionary at the polar opposite of empathy, the antonym, what would we find in the dictionary? Empathy antonym is?
So like self-importance, I think, or in, what a great question. Opposite of empathy, it's just selfishness.
There you go. There could be several, right? There is selfishness, tyranny, cold-heartedness, uncaringness, all of these things. Things we would, anybody pretty much would say, I don't want to be resonating that. I'm empathetic. So we look at, Tune-Up says, well, there's actually a positive opposite to empathy. It's not an extreme opposite. It's a positive opposite. So we look for what's the positive frequency of cold-heartedness or the positive frequency of selfishness. And it might be something like discernment or particularity or maybe even self-care or something. Because we know that empathy also, when stretched to its extreme, can become like codependence, mm-hmm. right? Or lack boundarylessness, which is also not so good.
Damaging to everybody as well in a different way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, we have the technology. We just have to get the word out. And to do it in an embodied way brings it into where we can actually make change, because we can't make change only in our heads. As we know as musicians, if we just sat and thought about the music, there'd be no sound. So it has to come through the body.
All I can think about is, and we spoke about this very briefly before we started recording, is if we had politicians in a choir and as you were talking about tension and passing tones and you know, that they understand if there's you know, we're modulating or the chord is changing, and that tension just before we resolve is that all the voices must be equal, otherwise it doesn't sound very good, it sounds wrong. So there is tension, but it's tension but a quality of the voices, and then we, you know, then the tension note resolves and suddenly we have the harmony again. So imagine if we had a choir with our politicians where they were able to, exactly as you're talking about, embody that feeling of the tension and the release. We need to go do this, Anna, I think. I would just love to dig back a little then, because where we last left your journey was the Ensemble of Comedy and that experience. So where next from there did your choices in life take you?
Well, I looked around for a program where I could bring my gift of listening on the crisis line, my gift of improv, and my love of music. And it turned out that it was a degree in counseling psychology. And I found a program that I could do. It was a distance learning program. This is before all the online learning programs that we now have. I found one that I could do with very few missed rehearsals from my professional job, but the orchestra told me that I would need to choose between my interest in psychology and my interest in remaining employed, in so many words. So I found a way to do it anyway, and I won't go into the details here, but that took some grit. It also took a lot of community. It took my husband getting me to the airport at 3:30 in the morning. But it was a very exciting time to advocate for what I knew I must have in order to keep going. And that degree led to individual private practice for a number of years. I specialized in a form of therapeutic theater called psychodrama, which means soul in action, which was the most similar thing to playing in an orchestra I had ever seen, because instead of just talking about issues, we actually take roles. So I might, and there's a director and a conductor who's facilitating enactments on the spot to redo situations that did not go so well, and to dream up future states that we might want to experience to warm up to them. It's miraculous, and there's an enormous body of work and literature on the method. And that finally has led to my work with organizations, my role as the director of eco-social development at the family business, and just bringing all of these skills, I guess, together in one place to work with as many kinds of people as I can.
Anna, I'm really interested in this, the through line of the embodied experience, or the where has that come from? Because I've spoken to quite a few musicians who've gone on to further training in psychology, but it's all very much from the chin up is the work that they do. And your work is not that at all. And I'm just really interested, where has that come from?
Again, I think it's a beautiful intersection of what's happening now in sort of the cutting edge work of somatics, somatic experiencing, Peter Levine's work. Resma Minicum is a trauma specialist from Minneapolis who does trauma work through body work. Pat Ogden's work is about the body, but mine is of reclaiming. So when I was a little girl, the first time I heard music really was on my father's record player playing Winchester Cathedral. And I remember, it's one of my first memories of just doing this while Winchester Cathedral. And it wasn't just listening to it, my body was doing it. And we'd be in the car and I'd be riding in the back seat. And as soon as that motion of the car started, I started singing. So for me, my body's always been part of it. And then I think my classical training, especially when it came to taking auditions and being evaluated for it and realizing, oh my gosh, this is how I'm going to make a living and AKA survive, that's when I cut off from my body. I started doing yoga again in the mid-90s, which gave me permission to be back in my body. And I started using my yoga practice. Nobody was teaching yoga and anxiety at that point, but I would use the same grounding techniques to ground myself. And so I've never left that awareness that it has to be in the body.
I see, because I see so many young musicians living a life from their eyebrows up, and they're so... Yeah, and professional orchestras.
And frowning from the eyebrows down, right?
Yes, like, and just this, and you look at jazz musicians and their whole body is all other genres of music.
Yeah.
Is embodied, and yet we just have our butt cheeks on the chair and we forget that we exist from the eyebrows down. And I think what a loss to the music. Mm-hmm. What a loss to the storytelling that we're not bringing that into it.
Well, and I hate to say it, but my prediction is it will be a loss to the art form if we don't start smiling when we're playing and we don't start turning and smiling at our audiences.
Yeah. And if we stop And we, oh gosh, the next time I see an orchestra, when the audience is clapping, which is the audience is so moved that they're slapping their hands together out of joy. And what are the musicians doing? They're turning the pages. I just want to scream at them about that. We're giving you, we're loving you. We're giving you our love and gratitude, and you are refusing to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I learned a lot about that when I left full-time professional playing. Being out in the audience in the dress circle, looking back several years after leaving the orchestra and being moved again. I'd never been somebody that really enjoyed going to orchestra concerts. I just wanted to be doing it. But going back as a member of the audience, recognizing the big picture of what's happening and the communications that could be coming back and forth from stage to audience and audience to stage. They call that the fourth wall. And there are some musicians who are breaking that fourth wall. I'm actually saddened to hear that it's not more prevalent that the fourth wall has been broken from what you're still seeing in music schools right now. Because there's so much opportunity there. And number one, they could be having so much more fun.
There's yeah, there's still, it's still frowned almost in certain faculties of the schools of music. There are certain instruments that have the traditions where even speaking from the stage is frowned upon. It's yeah, it's and
I
it's
wonder what that va I wonder what that value is, and I
when
wonder
it,
how it's extreme now.
and you if you asked why. And trying to be very, I have no emotional connection to your response. I'm just curious to know why is this perpetuated? How does this serve the audience? I mean, we're just underneath a glass cloche. You know, we're a little museum. We're a museum exhibit when we choose to conduct ourselves. Pardon the pun. Conduct ourselves like that. You know, we're a snapshot of Western European culture from 200 years ago. And if that's a curated decision because we believe that's how we best want to serve the audience, that's fine. But I don't believe most of it's a curated decision. It's purely replicating what they've seen without questioning.
So tradition is a lovely value, right? Tradition is a lovely value, but stretched to its extreme can become kind of like fundamentalism or those kinds of traditions that don't let anyone else close because anything else is not good enough. That's not such a tradition of balance and equipoise in my
No, and
book.
if the tradition was about we seek to serve and connect the audience through music, then that allows for process change. So in the world of 2022, what does that look like? And asking the audience, goodness forbid, what is it you need to feel more, to have a heightened emotional experience in the moment, and to truly listen to what they say? So if it's coming from the value of the tradition is coming from the value of we must seek to connect and serve through music, then we're not so rusted on to the practices of the past. Anna, one of my dreams is that imagine you've gone to Coachella and Beyoncé enters the stage and you can imagine the scene. Imagine if that was an orchestra concert. Imagine if there was that level of connection and anticipation and excitement from an orchestra. And it went both ways, and the love went both ways. Imagine that even before we broke the sacred silence with the music, if there was that. That's my dream, is that orchestra concerts are more like rock concerts with the love and the connection.
Absolutely. Well, we have similar dreams. This is one of my dreams too. And you'll be heartened to know that I mentioned some interviews I'd done with some musicians in their 20s in the US who are part of a training orchestra here, and they're sharing the same dream. So I think we now have an intergenerational component. We just have to build our quorum here.
And I hope for them, I hope for them it's not coming out of a sense of necessity of but a sense of true service to the audience. And because I don't think this the overall the schools of music are helping at all. And anyway, that's a whole conversation we could talk to for ages. So Anna, tell me, what is the work that you're doing at the moment that's nourishing your artistry and your musicianship? That's not music work, because but what is it that is what is nourishing your inner musical artist right now?
Well, I have been speaking with my friend Okaija Afroso, who's been a friend for many years, but we found each other again recently. Okaija is an extremely gifted musician from Ghana, and had come here in the early 1990s, I think, in a dance troupe with Obo Addy, and has developed his own sound. And we've been having some wonderful conversations about where our ancestry intersects and where we want to go from here. I'm from the United States South, where the terrible racist and slavery practices happened. And so my mother just turned 80, and it feels like part of my destiny to carry that story forward in a way that's generative and heal some of the roots of that land and that trauma that happened there. And Okaija, being from Ghana, West Africa, where the Europeans went, and bringing together his wisdom and his awareness of his culture and the history there, and doing some programs. We're still fishing around for what it's going to be, but we're going to be bridging those cultures and healing our own roots at the same time, I think. So that's extremely nourishing to me. Okaija just posted something on Facebook about, I didn't know this, but apparently the Europeans took instruments with them when they went to Africa, and left some instruments that are still used there. So I hesitate to say anything possible good could have come from that colonization and slavery, but I'm grateful the instruments are still singing and working and playing.
Anna, I love the phrase you used about to develop your own sound. And I have we've been very fortunate to meet in person previously a few years ago, and that is what struck me about you, is your sense of knowing who you are, or being on the path to knowing who you are, and speaking your truth. And that's such a gift, and I hope that anybody listening today takes that notion of, for every young musician, I wish that that was the slogan for them, was I'm finding my own sound in whatever voice it is, that if they're using an instrument or the spoken word. Such a gift, and you've spoken with such clarity about the value of your, not only your music training, but your artistic voice, and being purpose-led in uplifting others. And it's just so such a gift to hear your story. Just a final question for you. Are you playing at the moment?
Well, I play all the time.
Hey!
And sometimes I play the viola. my viola is sitting here right next to me with its Play More Viola bumper sticker on the case. So I will say yes. It's a matter of frequency. I come to it in different ways more and more, and less, depending on the other ways that I'm expressing myself in the world. It's all music.
And how does it feel when it's in your hands?
It feels like home.
Anna, thank you so much. I'll put the links to everything we've discussed and the wonderful other artists who you mentioned in the show notes, if anybody would like to go go down the rabbit hole. Thank you so much for your time today and for the work that you do in using your creative and artistic and musical voice in such a diverse range of ways. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for being a fierce advocate for all of us.
Hey, thanks for listening and for making it all the way to the end. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please help me share these stories by sharing this with others. You can post about it on your socials, on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, or you can leave me a rating and a review about this podcast. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Facebook or Instagram at Notable Values. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.